You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire.
Iran's crackdown on internet channels of dissent continues. Intel processors are determined to have a deep security flaw, and cloud users are likely to be affected. A macOS local privilege escalation vulnerability is published. The TrackMageddon location service vulnerability seems to originate in a buggy API. The Suicide Forest video appears to have passed through YouTube's human curators. And the man arrested in the Wichita police shooting may have been a serial swatter. I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Wednesday, January 3rd, 2018. Iran continues to crack down on dissent as the government faces street protests and online organizing. Protesters and their supporters are dissatisfied with the Islamic Republic on at least two points. They object to what they characterize as a badly mismanaged economy, whose privations have been rendered worse by official corruption. And they see the regime as being far too concerned with things going on outside the country. Support for Hezbollah in particular and the Palestinian cause in general have been singled out for chanted denunciation by protesters. There have also been surprising expressions of nostalgia for Shah Reza Pahlavi, deposed by the Islamic Revolution of January 1979. There seem to have been no calls by protesters for the release of still interned leaders of the failed 2009 Green Revolution. Statements by senior officers in Iran make it clear that in their view, the unrest is driven by foreign enemies whose weapon is information. That concern is about alleged foreign involvement in what has the appearance of grassroots protests. The chief deputy of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Brigadier General Jazayeri, said yesterday that anyone who remained silent in the face of what the Mehr news agency called a comprehensive plan of enemies to change beliefs, thoughts, and behavior of the nation should be held to account. As the brigadier general put it, quote, "In the current situation, urgent and decisive measures should be taken by the relevant agencies to achieve secure and domestic cyberspace," end quote. The leader of the Revolutionary Guard said this afternoon that the uprisings had been decisively put down, but few observers are so far willing to accept that assertion at face value. More than 20 are reported to have been killed since last Thursday. Nearly 500 are thought to have been arrested. Government-organized counter-demonstrators took to the streets this morning to denounce the protests and chant "Death to America," following the regime's line that the unrest had been fomented by enemies abroad. Tehran has sought to restrict internet access in order to deprive dissenters with both a platform and a means of organization. Telegram and Instagram have so far received most of the government's attention. As ready access to these platforms is lost, many in the country seem to be turning to Tor connections for internet access. While the cyber implications of the Islamic Republic's response have for the most part been domestic, confined to Iran, security experts warn those outside of Iran who may have had actual or apparent contact with Iranian citizens to beware of spear phishing. This is expected to be carried out by the government-associated INFI threat group. INFI has in the past shown a willingness and ability to target foreign persons of interest. A major security flaw has been reported in Intel x86 processors produced over the past decade. Details remain sketchy as Intel prepares an announcement, but apparently attackers can identify and exploit normally protected kernel memory. All major operating systems are affected. Users of cloud services may also experience issues noticeable as slowdowns in their service. Amazon Web Services has told users to expect a major security update Friday. Observers speculate that Microsoft will address the problem in its January 10 patches. AMD has noted with pardonable satisfaction that its chips don't suffer from this flaw. On January 1, 2018, some new security requirements kicked in for government contractors who work for the Department of Defense or intelligence community. They are now mandated to comply with a NIST special publication 800-171. Thomas Jones is a federal systems engineer with Bay Dynamics, and he helps us make sense of the new mandate.
December 30th, 2015, the DOD actually amended two of their requirements for compliance with contracts. So if you're going to do business with the DOD, you had to actually fall into two areas, new areas within the DFAR contracts. One's around protection of controlled unclassified information, and the other one's around reporting breaches within your organization. So it reaches outside of what is normally considered federal purview into the contractor community or into the civilian community, and actually tells them how to set and control safety standards in their IT systems. So this is one of the first times they've done that for non-classified information. There's always been something in place for classified information, things that are secret or top secret or what have you. But this actually touches upon the non-classified information, the social security numbers of individuals, the contact information, as well as sensitive but non-classified information that you simply wouldn't want other people to have, from an individual perspective and from a national perspective.
So what are the real-world practical implications of this?
Well, it's actually been very interesting. A lot of times you implement these with contractors, and it's a fairly straightforward process. You tell them that their contracts are dependent upon them, and they roll them out. But this one's a little different in that it's not just the prime contractors that had to be in line with these requirements. It's also the subcontractors. So each one of the primes have to go back to their subcontractors and make sure that they're actually adhering to these best practices. And that becomes a little dicey when you're talking about subcontractors that are two or three men, mom and pop shops, where they don't have the resources to implement this. So the real world implications are that you potentially have a situation where a prime contractor could lose a multi-million dollar contract based on a small subcontractor not being able to or not being aware of the requirements around protecting the controlled unclassified information.
Did these requirements become retroactive?
And no, it's not. There's actually been a softening of the general requirement, and I call it a softening. The DOD is saying there's no change at all, but they're simply requiring by the January 1st deadline that people have a reporting mechanism in place. So you can generate a report saying that you're compliant with these 14 key areas of 800-171. And in those areas that you may not have actually implemented the controls, that you have a plan to get in place and a date to get in place by, which is a little softer than having to have all those controls in place by the January 1st deadline, which is the way most contractors have been approaching this.
So is there a secondary deadline now that's been put out there for having to actually have things in place?
Not that I've been able to find. It's and I've been searching long and hard for that. But there doesn't seem to actually be anything in place that, you know, draws a line in the sand and says, you know, by this date, you need to have these in place. What you do need to have in place by January 1st is a plan to actually fulfill all 14 key areas within your organization, including identification of the data that has to be protected, a risk assessment of the organization to determine, you know, what the critical controls need to be in place first, what patches need to actually be implemented first, and what risks really are your greatest risk within the organization, as well as things like encrypting data in rest, data in motion, and doing things like controlling the flow of data within the organization, where it can go, who can access it, and the ways it may be accessed.
That's Thomas Jones from Bay Dynamics. A researcher known by the handle Seguza has published a macOS local privilege escalation vulnerability that could be exploited for root access and code execution. The vulnerability was apparently not disclosed to Apple before publication. There's currently no fix available, but Cupertino is doubtless working on one. The flaw is not believed to be remotely exploitable. You would need physical access to work your bad magic, which renders the bug less interesting to SCIDs and script kiddies. Seguza cites this, and Apple's lack of a bug bounty program, in justification of his decision to publicly disclose his findings, as opposed to giving Apple a heads up. Two researchers yesterday disclosed issues with a vulnerable API used for GPS tracking services that can expose location data, audio recordings, image files, and device information. They're calling it TrackMageddon. The afflicted sites are policing themselves up one by one. Logan Paul's now infamous and repellent YouTube video from Japan's suicide forest has been taken down, and an apology from Paul posted in its place. Paul's fans and detractors have taken their predictable defensive or offensive stances. YouTube itself has come in for more interesting criticism. Both Wired Magazine and TechCrunch have called out the video platform, Wired arguing that the incident should be a reckoning, and TechCrunch deciding that YouTube is more responsible for the video than one might at first judge a platform to be. According to the report in TechCrunch, YouTube manually reviewed the video after concerned viewers flagged it. The content assessment team saw the video and, according to the report, left it up without so much as an age restriction. It's not as if the nature of the content was particularly difficult to discern, of course. The video's title, you recall, was "We Found a Dead Body in the Japanese Suicide Forest," and the thumbnail showed the suicide victim. Logan Paul might be accused of many things, but failure to judge what would prove to be clickbait is not among them. The incident again shows the difficulty of content management, whether by machines, humans, or some centaur mix of the two. It also shows why Google is likely to remain in hot water in the UK, where it recently failed to respond to questions about extremist content posed by Parliament's Home Affairs Committee. Tyler Raj Barris, or at least his online persona Swatistic, is said by Krebs on Security to have tweeted late last week a boast of having called in bomb threats or SWAT teams at some 10 homes and more than 100 schools. Barris was arrested in connection with the tragic and lethal swatting attack that took the life of an innocent and uninvolved father of two late last week. The victim's address seems to have been chosen for its plausible proximity to the actual target and for the lulls. Explaining himself to Krebs on Security, Barris said, quote, "Bomb threats are more fun and cooler than SWATs, in my opinion, and I should have just stuck to that. But I began making dollars doing some SWAT requests," end quote. The investigation continues, looking at both the police officer who fired and for other gamers who might have been involved in the dispute that led to the swatting. Our heartfelt condolences to the family of the victim, Andrew Finch. May they receive comfort, consolidation, and justice. And joining me once again is Joe Kerrigan. He's from the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute. Joe, welcome back.
Hey, Dave.
So we have survived another holiday season, and with that is going to come a flood of new IoT devices
yep.
hitting the web. We'll probably receive some ourselves.
Yes, people gadgets.
Gadgets, being gadget guys. People will give us things with best intentions.
And say, here, you can use this.
Just, yeah. And the first thing that device is going to want is your Wi-Fi password.
That's right. Access to your network.
Right.
And it wants to go connect to some external server and start uploading data somewhere. And it also may want to create some external port. Like there might be some kind of camera where you now can go out and view your camera, a security camera, for example, from the outside world. So if you're at work, you can check on your dog and your cat, you know, watch what the nanny's doing if you have a nanny.
Sure.
People should be aware that when these things come, they're going to come with some default password. That's the first thing I'm going to recommend. If you get a new device that is accessible on the internet, first off, evaluate, do you truly need this device?
That's do you need that connectivity?
Do you need that connectivity?
Right.
If you believe that you do, take the time to secure it and change the default passwords.
Sure.
So that people aren't just, you know, logging in remotely or putting it in some botnet like the Mariah botnet.
And do that, I mean, quickly, away. You can do
quickly.
That in a way before it's connected to, because I've seen these reports where, you know, people will hose up a camera to the internet and it takes, I mean, it's moments before
right.
that thing is owned by outside forces.
That's correct. So if you can disconnect your internet connection and then connect the new device to the Wi-Fi network, and you can still actually connect to it from your computer, it just can't reach the internet. And then you can go ahead and change the password if that's possible.
And what about the idea of basically having a guest network for all your IoT devices, so separating it from the computers where you keep important information?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend doing that if you have that technical capability and the hardware to do it. Yeah, that's always a good thing to do. It's segmentation. It's a basic security practice. It's a good idea. However, that's not going to stop those things from being attacked from outside of your network. They're
right.
still going to get attacked. You're just going to have that attack be isolated. And it will be less damaging. So you still need to take measures to make sure that the devices themselves are protected.
All right. Good advice. Joe Kerrigan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Dave.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Puru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.